A civil rights group is upset over a new non-lethal weapon that's being deployed at a troubled jail in Los Angeles County. The device shoots a beam of high-frequency energy, supposedly harmless, but extremely painful. The jail says it's better than using bullets and billy clubs to put down an inmate riot, but critics say the device may not be as safe as advertised. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
Locked inside the Pitches Detention Center north of L.A., officials showed off their latest tool for subduing rioting inmates. It resembles a supersized dental x-ray machine with a flat screen on top, and it works something like out of Star Trek.
You know, when they set their phasers to stun, they did that so that they didn't kill people. Well, that's exactly what this is that it does stun you.
Mike Bowen is a vice president of Raytheon Missile Systems, which built the device for the L.A. County Jail, a scaled-down version of what it designed for the military.
You know, I don't care if you're the meanest, toughest person in the world. This will get your attention and make your brain focus on making it stop rather than doing whatever you were planning on doing, so...
Riots are nothing new at this jail. The Pitches Detention Center has a history of bloody inmate violence, some of it recent.
A huge fight broke out at a Southland jail this afternoon. Authorities say up to 600 inmates were involved in the disturbance at Pitches Detention Center in Castaic.
The latest brawl between 200 inmates broke out 2 days after the Raytheon device was unveiled. Dave Judge, the operation deputy for the Sheriff's Department, says the machine is more effective than their usual methods. Firing rubber bullets and tear gas grenades.
This is tame. This is mild. This is a great way to intervene without causing any harm. The nice thing about this is it allows you to intervene at a distance.
He says with the remote control device, guards can focus on specific targets using a monitor and a joystick. Raytheon's Bowen says the device sends out millimeter waves, creating a harmless but intense sensation.
And it penetrates about a 64th of an inch under your skin where your pain receptacles are. So what it would feel like to you is if you just open up the doors of a blast furnace, you'd feel this wave of heat. You feel that immediately.
Oh!
Estrella TV reporter Andres Herrera was one of the nervous volunteers as sheriff's deputies had a field day testing the device on the media.
That's hot.
Brian Day from the Pasadena Star flinched from the pain and jumped out of the way.
First it's just a warmth, and then it just really starts to, it becomes an intense burning sensation real quick.
I'm going
to
try it.
Okay. Oh, ow, they got me in the face.
No, they got me in the neck is where they got me. Can you believe that? In the neck.
10 minutes later, I spoke to Dave Judge from the Sheriff's Department.
I can kind of still, maybe it's in my mind, but I feel like I can still feel this pain on my neck.
Well, you know, that's the mind and that's the memory. So you burn that sensation into your mind, which is a positive thing, because we want individuals to remember what this feels like so that if they are inclined to do something, they may think twice.
No, 3 years ago, the Department of Defense demonstrated a bigger version of the device. As a group of people pretended to protest, the machine was turned on. The protest was fake, but the sensation of burning flesh was real. Now Los Angeles has been given a smaller civilian version of the same device for free, but the ACLU says that's a bad idea.
We're going to use people in the jails as guinea pigs for some mega arms builder to test their device.
ACLU attorney Peter Eliasberg is asking the L.A. sheriff to reconsider using what he says has a potential to be a torture device.
These weapons are sort of always sold as safe. They're new, they're high-tech, they're safe, nobody gets hurt. Well, we heard that about tasers, and yet what we subsequently find is that, in fact, tasers cause heart attacks with people if they're repeatedly jolted.
Eliasberg says L.A. deputies have a documented history of abusing inmates, and he suggests a better solution would be to prevent the overcrowded conditions that triggered jail riots in the first place. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
Now, in other countries around the world, including right here in the U.S., there are people who are abandoning Yahoo and Google and turning to other search engines, ones that provide results that meet their religious standards. Habiba Nosheen reports.
If you like what the internet has to offer, but are concerned that your web searches may lead you to content that's offensive to your religious beliefs, there's a solution for that. you can now use one of several search engines that cater to religious users. Shay Hoodman runs SeekFind.org, the Colorado-based organization, says its searches only return results from websites that are consistent with the message of the Bible.
With the purpose of SeekFind being to promote what we believe to be biblical truth, we can't include a site that we believe does not do that.
Hoodman says a search on his site wouldn't turn up pornography. If you search gay marriage, you would get results that argue against gay marriage. And if you type in Democratic Party, your first search result is a site on Marxism. But SeekFind isn't the only search engine carving a niche market among religious internet users. There's also Jugal.com for Jews and I'mHalal.com, a Muslim search engine that started in the Netherlands. Hussein bin Yunus is a 44-year-old Muslim man from New Zealand. He found out about I'mHalal.com about 8 months ago, and now he says he's a fan.
I do use it at home and at work and everywhere.
Bin Yunus says the search engine offered him content that he can trust would be appropriate for him as a practicing Muslim. And he's much more comfortable allowing his teenage son to use the internet. For example, a search for sex on I'm Halal would return results giving the Islamic view on sexuality. But there are glitches. Sometimes it's too restrictive. A search for sexuality returned no results on I'm Halal. Reza Sharda says it's a work in progress. The 21-year-old says he got the idea for I'm Halal about a year ago after finding that for some in the Muslim community, the internet was effectively off limits.
People were avoiding the internet because they were afraid they or their children would bump into explicit content. It's a shame.
Currently, Sharda says, the biggest number of users come from Pakistan. But surprisingly, he says, the second biggest group comes from the United States. Websites like these are bringing in new users to the web, says Michael Gerdenberg, a partner at the Altimeter Group, a technology research firm.
You have an emerging generation, an emerging culture that wants to take advantage of technology, that wants to take advantage of search engines and the things that they provide, but at the same point be true to their heritage as well and not stray from their belief system.
But not everyone has been supportive of the idea. Some people call it censorship. Shay Hoodman of SeekFind disagrees.
I would more describe it as selective inclusion.
Some who oppose such search engines argue that allowing people to only access material that they already agree with will lead to an intolerant society. But technology analyst Gerdenberg says he doesn't see it that way.
It's no more censorship than if I find something on television that I find offensive to me and I change the channel.
I'm Halal says within the first year since its launch, it's already getting 10 million users a month. And with that kind of traffic, these search engines are likely here to stay. For NPR News, I'm Habiba Nosheen.
The Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in New York is also hard at work, still trying to identify remains of victims from the World Trade Center attack. Of the more than 2,700 people reported missing, more than 1,600 have been identified, two as recently as January.
Over the past few years, advancements in DNA testing have helped with the effort. Workers have also continued to recover human remains from the area, from previously inaccessible sites, including some underground. As of today, there are still 1,123 victims of the World Trade Center attack whose remains have yet to be identified.
This summer, New York's Deputy Mayor for Operations, Stephen Goldsmith, wrote in a memo, "The city has not wavered in its dedication to finding and identifying those lost on September 11th." And he says, "The search for remains will continue for the foreseeable future."
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Spygate is officially over. Those words from a town council member in Riverhead, New York, on Long Island. The Spygate he's referring to doesn't involve Russian double agents or top secret security breaches. It's all about swimming pools. The town of Riverhead has voted to stop using Google Earth satellite images to find backyard pools that don't have proper permits. Leroy Barnes, Jr. is Riverhead's chief building inspector. Thanks for being with us.
How are you?
I'm okay. Now, when did you start using Google Earth to find these pools?
About a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh. And how many total number of pools did you find that were not in compliance, didn't have the right permits?
Well, there were people that had open permits, but that had expired, so I consider them not having permits. So there was a total of 250 pools that had either an open permit with no inspection, or there were pools that had no permits at all to begin with and were constructed.
And you were able to figure that out by looking at these satellite images and comparing them against,
correct,
I guess, the records.
And also checking on our building permit system to see if they had a permit. So when they started to look at the ones that had expired, we started stumbling across ones that had no permits to begin with. And that's when we started using the Google Earth to verify.
Hmm. Did you have anybody complaining to you about privacy and how you found out?
Well, you know, it's funny. Most of the people that complained were the ones that didn't have the permits.
Well, yeah.
I've gotten a lot of emails and kind calls from people that live in the town, and they were happy that we were doing that because a lot of people don't get permits because they don't want to pay property taxes. So by not getting a permit, the assessors are not aware that those structures are there and they can't assess them. So that's what's created such an issue for people. But I use it strictly for safety.
And what are the safety issues that you're worried about here?
Well, every pool that's constructed in the state of New York has to have a legal barrier around the pool, and it also has to be alarmed. You have to have a barrier, which is a 4-foot fence with a self-closing, self-latching gate. And also, you're supposed to have alarms on your rear doors in the fenced area of the rear yard, so that if you have kids and they go outside, the alarm trips, so they know their kids are in the backyard. And, you know, people leave gates open, unlocked, and kids do fall in pools, and they do drown. I mean, our local, our Newsday, which is an island-wide newspaper, certainly gave a very nice editorial towards my office and me, saying that it was about time that some of the towns are using their heads and using the resources available that are free.
So when you hear one of the town council members there in Riverhead refer to this as Spygate, maybe he's joking, maybe he's not. What do you think?
I think they're doing it affectionately, honestly. You know, I talked to Mr. Gabrielson about it after, so, you know, he's not trying to be offensive to me or anyone else. I think he was just joking around, and it turned out to be called Spygate, but we're not really spying.
Well, Mr. Barnes, it's good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Melissa, and you have a good day and a nice weekend.
You too.
Take care.
That's Leroy Barnes, Jr. He's the chief building inspector for Riverhead, Long Island, where the town council voted Wednesday to stop using Google Earth or other satellite images to find pools without permits.
Our program is directed by Jonathan Baer, edited by Corey Turner, and produced by Franklin Cater. The technical director is Peter Olena. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
The staff includes Julia Buckley, Andrea Hsu, Gabe O'Connor, Viet Le, Rob Ballinger, Brendan Banizak, Sonari Glinton, Shireen Meraji, and Rhonda Ray.
Jerry Holmes is filling in as executive producer for Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This week, students at Harrisburg University in Pennsylvania will take part in an experiment. The provost of the school, Eric Darr, has decided to block all social media sites on the campus network for an entire week. And that means no Facebook, no Twitter, no instant messaging programs, nothing. And Eric Darr says he got the idea while watching his daughter.
16-year-old, Facebook, iTunes, IM windows up, simultaneously having multiple conversations on her iPhone with friends. And then kind of witnessing some of that same behavior in the students at Harrisburg University and thinking, you know, what if that wasn't there?
Now, Eric Darr says he isn't doing this to punish students. He sees it as a kind of academic exercise. And at the end of the week, students will have to write essays about life in social media exile.
Critically, how does one examine how you use tools and technologies? We could have taken the approach, think about it. Well, that's sometimes hard to do. Often there are behaviors or habits, ways that we use technology that we may ourselves not even be able to articulate because we're not aware of them.
That's Eric Darr. He's the provost at Harrisburg University in Pennsylvania. I'll hand over the story now to Brent Bachman. He's one of our producers.
I talked with a few students at the university about this.
Hi, I'm Ashley Harris.
Giovanni Acosta.
Yemi Apuape.
I'm a senior.
Junior.
A student at Harrisburg University.
They're all friends.
Yes.
Yeah, we all know each other.
But they've got mixed reactions about the experiment.
I think the program would be okay. Most of us, we can deal with it. Some of us can't. I don't know if Ashley.
I'm going to have a hard time not being able to tell people where I'm at, being able to find people. I use Facebook and Twitter to find people at school to see where they're at, where they're studying.
I'm not a big fan of Facebook or any of those social networking sites. I think I'll be fine. I can't say the same for the rest of the students, but me personally, I'll be okay.
It's hard to nail down exactly how often students use these tools and exactly how much of their time will change this week. That's because they're more or less constantly connected.
I personally had to cut off Facebook during my sleep time because I have it straight to my phone. So when somebody texts me or sends me a Facebook status or a tweet, my phone rings. And at 3 in the morning, that's not too pleasant sometimes if you're trying to go to sleep. So I set a time limit. So between 3 and 6 in the morning, it just cuts off my phone. I could actually sleep between that time.
Ashley, Gio, and Yemi all said that one reason the blackout won't be so bad is that they have other ways to connect with each other. Their own smartphones, for example. And Provost Eric Darr says that will be part of the experiment.
If someone feels the need to borrow their friend's phone to go check Facebook, it'll be interesting to ask the question at the end of the week, why did you feel the need to do that? What compelled you to do that? We're not trying to stop all access to these sites. We're trying to at least put in a hurdle and make it enough for people to think about it.
Students will have ways around those hurdles. Off-campus students will keep their unrestricted access, and everyone still has email. But I asked Ashley, Gio, and Yemi what it might be like if they couldn't use that most popular form of communication, the text message.
Wow.
No.
That's something scary to imagine, actually. No texting.
No, I couldn't do it. No. That's not even a question. It might be a relief. I'm going to commit, and I'm going to see what it's like for a week if I talk to people face-to-face more, if I connect more. I might get some homework done.
The voices of students from Harrisburg University, they spoke to our producer, Brent Bachman. Another perspective on social media caught our eye this past week. This one came from Jaron Lanier. He's a computer scientist who appeared on Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people of the year. Now, back in the 1980s, he was a pioneer in the field of virtual reality.
So I'm not a technophobe. I adore technology. I describe myself as something of a devoted technologist. I'm geeky, I'm nerdy, and proud of it.
But Jaron Lanier is also an outspoken critic of social media. He calls it a network of fake friendships and digital Maoism ruled by a mob. So we asked him what he thought of the experiment at Harrisburg University.
I have mixed feelings about it. A prohibition might be extreme. What I'd prefer to do is to have a system in place where a student has to devote a penny to charity for every access to Facebook page or for every tweet. I'd like them to have to pay for it because that would create awareness. They'd be aware of how much they were doing, making the use of it into something that's more conscious and more considered.
You call Facebook and other social networking sites, and I'm quoting you, anti-human software. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what you mean by that?
I mean, basically what's happening is you're representing yourself on a database. Then you live according to that database. You fill in check marks saying, this is what I'm interested in. This is who I am. This is the music I want to hear. And you become a caricature of yourself. And I do think that's anti-human because I think the core of being human is having the right and the responsibility to invent yourself. And if some company off in the distance, particularly one that traffics in advertising, becomes in charge of that for you, you've really given up something of the core of yourself.
You say you have hope for the post-Facebook generation. How would that happen? What would it look like?
What I'm really hoping is for a renaissance of the most positive sense of American reinvention in which a new generation of young people say, no, we are individuals. We invent ourselves. We invent our own taste. We decide what friendship means. And furthermore, we intend to make a living because we're not subordinate. We're Americans. And I'm waiting for a generation. And you know what? I think they're here.
That's Jaron Lanier, virtual reality pioneer and most recently author of the book, You Are Not a Gadget. He joined me from UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. Mr. Lanier, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm David Green, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today, Microsoft announced new measures aimed at protecting NGOs from government harassment. The move comes in response to a story in the New York Times over the weekend about an incident in Russia. Last January, police there raided the offices of an environmental group, claiming that it was using pirated Microsoft software. The group has denied the charge. Clifford Levy wrote the story that led to all of this, and the New York Times Moscow bureau chief joins us now from Russia's capital. Hi, Cliff.
Hi.
The group that was raided is called Baikal Environmental Wave, and they were as you reported, organizing protests over a polluting factory that Prime Minister Putin had ordered reopened. And you found in this case and in some other cases that lawyers retained by Microsoft were actually backing the Russian police.
That's right. I mean, the authorities have increasingly used this tactic to exert pressure on advocacy groups and opposition newspapers in Russia. They essentially, without warning, come in and will take the computers of these groups and say that they're investigating whether or not they have pirated software on the computers. The groups are all but paralyzed from these raids. Obviously, you can imagine if all of a sudden all your computers were taken. And essentially, it's what the authorities, I think, believe is a kind of a very clever way of squelching dissent in Russia.
So the police come in, they take the computers saying that they think there's pirated software. Is there any evidence that maybe they were looking for something legitimate otherwise? I mean, pirated software?
Pirated software is rampant in Russia. By some estimates, 60, 70, 80% of the computers have it. This is really an issue of selective prosecution. These raids are almost never carried out against groups or newspapers or media outlets that are friendly to the government. They're really almost only carried out against opponents of the government. These advocacy groups and these newspapers are essentially charging that lawyers retained by Microsoft in these cases are supporting the authorities, are essentially saying, yes, there was a loss to Microsoft here. They're signing statements saying Microsoft was a victim in these cases and assisting the authorities in these inquiries.
And this morning, now we get some news from Microsoft. The general counselor offered, what sort of a mea culpa. What exactly did he say on behalf of the company?
So before the article came out, I had talked to Microsoft in both Moscow and in Redmond, Washington, where their world headquarters is. And they obviously expressed concern about some of these allegations and said that they were going to examine what was going on and tighten oversight of its lawyers in Russia. And on Monday morning, the general counsel of Microsoft issued a 1,400-word statement in which he extensively apologized for the situation and said Microsoft would take a number of steps to remedy it. But one of the most interesting is that they announced that they would essentially grant a blanket software license to any nonprofit group or opposition newspaper in Russia. What that means is that even if the group didn't ask for a license, they would automatically consider to have it. And therefore, the government or the police or prosecutors would not be able to bring any sort of software piracy cases against those particular group because Microsoft would not in any way support the case.
And Cliff, I want to ask it sort of the other direction. I mean, now that the company, Microsoft, has made sort of a blanket statement they're not going to get involved in cases like this, might that hurt them in the future if there is a legitimate argument to take computers away from some sort of group that might actually have pirated software?
From Microsoft's point of view, they're not that interested in going after a tiny advocacy group. What they really want is the authorities in Russia and China and all these countries where software is rampant. They want the authorities to go after suppliers, distributors, and manufacturers of pirated software. What had been happening here is it seemed like they felt they were getting dragged into these small cases, and I think they hadn't really focused on the ramifications of that.
We've been speaking to Clifford Levy, the Moscow bureau chief of the New York Times. Thanks, Cliff.
Thanks for having me.